I'm Rick Ganley. This is NHPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Elections are, by nature, divisive affairs, but after they're over, politicians often call for Americans to come together as one. And in polls, many people these days do say they're tired of partisanship and gridlock. But our guest today says, despite nostalgic appeals for a unified nation, in truth, there has never been one America, but rather several. We're talking with Colin Woodard, author of a new book, American Nations, a history of the 11 rival regional cultures of North America. In it, he describes the roots of our differences based upon the interests and backgrounds of the people who settled here, even though long ago these distinctions became indelible and continue to shape our modern political debates. Woodard's regions include Yankeedom, which covers New England and regions as far west as North Dakota, an area which values education and local community. There's Greater Appalachia, a volatile collection of Scots-Irish clans who fiercely distrust government. There's El Norte, a hybrid of Anglo and Spanish America, which includes parts of Mexico. And there's the Left Coast, embracing both Yankee intellectualism with a strong dose of individual self-discovery. All told, he says, these 11 cultures have played a huge role in our history, from the Civil War to civil rights to our modern culture wars. Today in The Exchange, author Colin Woodard on the history of this unwieldy American nation and where the fissures remain today. Let's hear from you. Do you agree that we've never been united as Americans, that regional differences have always dominated? Or do you disagree, given the physical sameness of much of America and the mobility of the American public? Also, if you've lived elsewhere, what cultural differences have you experienced from region to region? Give us a call. We'd love to hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or email us, exchange@nhpr.org. And Colin Woodard joins us from a studio in Maine. Colin, great to have you. Thanks for your time.
A pleasure to be here.
Well, many people, as you say, you know, bemoan the partisanship we hear, hearkening back to earlier eras when we were supposedly more united. You say, though, look, we have never been united. There's never been one American ideal. There's never been one American philosophy or feeling. Really? Even in times of stress and 9/11, the Revolutionary War, even in times of crisis?
I mean, in times of crisis, there are occasions where the separate regional cultures come together, you know, especially if there's been a threat that affects all. I mean, that was true of the American Revolution and 9/11 and World War II. There are times, indeed, when we are united, but it is out of many one because the separate colonial clusters were founded with such enormous differences, and those fundamental values underneath have remained with us till today.
Till today, really. How do we see them today, these 11 regions?
Oh, you'll see them reflected if you sort of follow the map of where these colonial clusters formed and which parts of the continent they ended up settling in the years up to 1820. You'll see that same map, that initial settlement map, that formation of dominant cultures reflected on the Blue County, Red County maps for almost any closely fought election we've had since 1860, and certainly including recent ones, or in the maps of American dialects that linguists put together, or the maps of the dissemination of material culture and practices across the continent that cultural anthropologists put together over and over again, religious areas and stuff. There are major chords that are seen today and have been seen throughout our history.
Well, and you say in the book that to some extent this idea of uniqueness, distinctness, hearkening back to our earliest days might seem like a hard sell, Colin, given that there's a lot of sameness to the American landscape and to our media and to our entertainment. And I have to ask you, how sharp are these differences today? I mean, maybe 100 years ago, but today, in an era of Walmart and Pizza Hut and blockbuster movies that all open on the same day nationwide. You know what I'm saying there? I mean, really, still today.
Yeah, you would think that the homogenizing forces of mass culture would have undermined these regions. But in fact, if you look out there, that's not at all true and is seen in our polarized political landscape today. I mean, look at the primaries. A candidate from a given party is supposed to say one set of things to their party in New Hampshire and then pivot and say a completely different set of things to members of that same party in South Carolina. I mean, that right there in a nutshell is some of the cultural differences at work.
But because, you can't, You can't do that anymore, though, because of the internet and Twitter. And, you know, you say something in New Hampshire, I can put it up on YouTube in South Carolina.
It's made more difficult, but indeed, you emphasize one thing and perhaps by omission leave out another in the two different markets. You're always angling towards these things. The things that people will respond to in northern New England and in Yankeedom, even from a conservative perspective, and the things that people would emphasize in the Deep South are very different because the takes on what, you know, freedom means and liberty and what the correct balances between the divisions of church and state or between the individual's interest and the common good of the community, those all have different answers that go all the way back to the beginnings of our history 3 and 4 centuries ago. And you see them in the way people answer political polls today and in different preferences and the divisions in Congress and the regional orientation of those divisions.
You know, let's dig into that a little if we could, Colin. What are some of the core themes, and you just mentioned a couple, the role of religion, the role of community, the role of government. What are some of the core themes that these 11 regions don't always see eye to eye on?
One of the most important ones would be the great differences in what the meaning of a word like freedom means. I mean, that's why we end up in arguments. You know, each side, when we get very polarized, acts as though the other side is the enemy of freedom and all that it means to be an American. And to just illustrate that briefly, you know, in Yankeedom from the greater New England cultural space, from the early days of the Puritans when they arrived in Massachusetts Bay, they were concerned with the freedom of the community. They were involved in a utopian social engineering experiment, in essence, to create a more perfect society, right? The light on the hill, a new Zion for the rest of humanity to see in dark times. And that was essentially a project that would be carried through public institutions. Where individuals would have, there'd be self-denial and self-restraint. What's more Yankee than that notion, you know, built back in your character in order for the overall good of the community, the freedom of the community to be ensured. They were afraid that, you know, that freedom was about avoiding a tyrant appearing and becoming a new aristocrat or lord over them as there had been in the old world. So it's about restraining the individual if necessary to ensure the freedom of the community. That is absolutely the opposite of, say, in Greater Appalachia, which, as you mentioned in the intro, was settled by people from Scots-Irish from Ulster and Lowland Scots and people from the war-torn borderlands of Britain who settled the Appalachian uplands and from the 1730s onward, and they were coming from an environment where there was no effective government and rule of law. You had to protect yourself, your kith and kin in times of war, and things would be regularly destroyed. So there was an enormous emphasis on freedom being individual sovereignty, that the freedom of that freedom is to have the individual have as few encumbrances on them as possible. Now, when you think about that in policy terms, those are opposites. It's no surprise that the dominant regional cultures, those two divisions, don't quite see eye to eye on how best to ensure and define freedom. And even more so if you go to the Deep South, where you have a founded around Charleston, a generation or two after the Puritans arrived, was a culture that was a transplanted West Indian slave society from Barbados. So the initial founders of Charleston and the Deep South were Barbadian planters, and were their model of republicanism was a republicanism from classical antiquity, from ancient Greece and Rome, where a small oligarchy had the privilege of practicing democracy, and slavery was the natural lot of the many. So those are very different interpretations from our beginnings as to what freedom and republicanism and stuff would mean.
Wow, listening to you talk, Colin, I'm thinking it's amazing we're still together.
or that we ever came together.
Right.
It's really quite remarkable when you look at the colonial period.
Well,
it's an odd accident of history that we did.
Right. And you started on this project, Colin, as a scholar of colonial America, our earliest settled days. And I'd love to ask you a little bit more about that. You know, we all think of the Revolutionary War as a time of great coming together, and then the Civil War as a time of great coming apart. But you write, look, in between those two seminal moments, there were many, many attempts or thoughts or plans for other regions to quit the United States.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, of course, there's the 150 years before the Revolution that we'll get to. But by the time the Revolution happened, that was a shared threat that The British Empire had intended to force conformity on these unwieldy colonies, including, you know, ending their autonomy and a lot of their individual practices, and to try to make it a more centralized empire like the French practiced. And that common threat to local autonomy and local difference is what brought them together. I mean, essentially, it was a collective war of liberation with a bunch of threatened regional cultures coming together to defend each of their distinctiveness, each of their distinct features from an outside threat. So the after the war, it became extremely difficult for all of these very separate takes on what kind of country they should have to negotiate the compromises of running a confederal and a federal government. And during that time period between Yorktown and the Civil War, almost all of the regions tried to secede at one time or another.
Really?
I mean, the very first one was Yankeedom, Greater New England, during the War of 1812. There was great talk of seceding from the rest of the country because New Englanders did not agree with the aims of the War of 1812. But more importantly, they had come to discover in the decades since the American Revolution that they would be unable in the foreseeable future to dominate the institutions of federal government and to shape the country in their cultural image. And this was deeply distressing. So one of the few solutions was to get out of the country and to protect the New England way. And this was, you know, there was a convention to do so, and there was even talk between the governor of Massachusetts at the time was sending emissaries to Nova Scotia to negotiate with the British about possibly having British backing for an independence move. So it was a very, very seriously discussed at the time.
Well, and shortly around that time, too, after the Revolution, there were moves among some states in Greater Appalachia and the Deep South to join Mexico to create a new sort of nation state in that region of the country.
Yeah, there were portions. There were many conflicts going on in the aftermath of the American Revolution as to what that conflict it had been about, and what sort of, was it a revolution or was it simply a set of wars of liberation? And in Greater Appalachia, a lot of people did not like the answers, and there were attempts not to join Mexico yet, but to join the Spanish Empire for protection,
right,
and to become separate states on the other side of the mountain, separate nations.
All right, Colin, we'll talk more after a short break, and we'll take your calls too. So join us at 1-800-892-6477. Keep it right here.
Good morning, it's 9:19, and support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from B&H Management, presenting An Evening with Ronan Tynan in concert at the Palace Theatre in Manchester, May 17th at 7:30. Tickets now available at palacetheatre.org. And from Savvy Workshop and Print Savvy, providing innovative marketing support for business-savvy clients since 1998. On the web at savvyworkshop.com and at printsavvy.com. More in the book, American Nations on the Exchange, on NHPR, and at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, concerns over online privacy. New Hampshire weather for today, mostly sunny, high temperatures from 25 in the North Country, 35 to 40 in central parts of the state, and 45 in southern New Hampshire. For tonight, clear and cold, lows tonight near zero, north teens across central New Hampshire, and 20 in southern sections of the state. This program was recorded earlier. We won't be taking any new phone calls this morning.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, author Colin Woodard on the history of what he calls American nations, the 11 rival regions of North America. We're looking at these regions, how they became formed, and we'd like to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. In his book, Woodard says we've never been united as Americans, that regional differences in cultures have always dominated. Do you agree with that or not? Also, if you've lived elsewhere, what cultural differences have you seen from region to region? 1-800-892-6477 is our number. 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Colin, before we go to the phone, I did want to ask you about the waves of immigration that came to this country, especially between, gosh, I mean, it's been coming for a long time, but, you know, 1820, 1830, 1840. We've been looking at New Hampshire's immigration story all year and learning how that has shaped our state. How did these large numbers of immigrants who came after the basic regions were established affect these regions' cultures?
Yeah, an excellent question. And why did they not overwhelm these regional cultures, seeing as oftentimes their numbers were very great? And the answer is, I mean, the basic thesis is that the initial Euro-American settlement groups, when they arrived in a new area and successfully created a self-perpetuating society, that they'd laid down the cultural DNA, that the initial groups set the practices and norms of behavior and assumptions and values that everybody else encountered when they showed up in those areas, either from other regions or immigrants from elsewhere. And in essence, it's just like immigration in any other part of the world. Yes, immigration has, when new people come to an area, they enrich the culture around them and improve it, I hope, in many ways. But when one's children or grandchildren assimilate into the culture around them, my argument is that they haven't assimilated into an American culture, in quotes, but rather into one of these regional cultures, all the way down to the dialect that they're likely to speak. This dominant norms around them, you can like them or dislike them, embrace them or find them frustrating, but they're a fact that one has to deal with and greatly affects one's standards of behavior and norms that they encounter.
Well,
those immigration waves, that was true then, but it was also in some ways self-reinforcing of the differences between these regional cultures, because if you look at where people came during the great waves of immigration in the 19th century and up to the 1920s, they avoided almost entirely some regions and were attracted in great numbers to other specific ones, often because of the very cultural characteristics of those regions.
Okay, and the example, Exhibit A on this, that came up for me reading the book, Colin, was what you call New Netherland, a tiny region representing the New York City area. Sure, settled by the Dutch, but when I think of the New York City area today, I don't think, gee, that's a great hotbed of Dutch culture.
Absolutely. And the Dutch today are like 0.2% of the population of what I call New Netherland, the sort of greater Big Apple area, which includes northern New Jersey and a few of the southern counties in New York and the western part of Long Island.
You think melting pot when you think that area?
You do. I mean, the classic melting pot is a little south of there. But yes, it's a place. It's Dutch in this sense and is very much so and is illustrative of the power of the laying down of a cultural DNA of a place. That when the Dutch first settled the end of the island of Manhattan and created New Amsterdam, the village that became the city of New York later, that village had the characteristics of its namesake, Amsterdam, at home. And Amsterdam in the mid-17th century was the capital of the most sophisticated state in the Western world. It was a place that was the center of the Western world's banking, of the first foreign currency exchanges, the center of publishing, a place that valued the freedom of conscience and inquiry to a T, to the point where people persecuted from other regions of the country with strange and deviant views flocked there. That's where many of the great thinkers from England and Italy and elsewhere ended up publishing their works. They were all published in Amsterdam. And it was a multi-ethnic, multi-religious place with the Dutch not really preponderant. And that was true. That was true of Amsterdam. That was true of the village of New Amsterdam when it was 600 people. It was a place with, the Dutch in a minority. There were English settlers and Indians and Turkish people farming outside the walls and Protestants and Catholics and Sephardic Jewish people in large numbers because it was a colony that allowed them to come. I mean, it was a multi-ethnic commercial trading society from the beginning and has remained so to this day. It's a global city surrounding, with an emphasis on commerce, not an enormous emphasis on morality per se, but huge amount on tolerance and freedom of inquiry, even tolerance of slavery in the 1860s. I mean, it's tolerance in many ways, but it's a place very different and very different today than from anywhere else in any other city on the continent. And the reason is because of this Dutch precedent.
All right, Colin, lots to talk about, but let's invite our listeners to join us again, 1-800-892-6477. Our guest is Colin Woodard, writer, historian, journalist, and author of the book we're talking about, American Nations, A History of the 11 Rival Regional Cultures of North America. Our number 1-800-892-6477. What do you think about what Colin says about early settlers laying down the cultural DNA of our regions? Do you see that in the region where you lived or have lived? Or do you see our regions more changing and becoming part of a mass culture? Our number 1-800-892-6477. Our email exchange at nhpr.org. And Colin, let's go first to Don. Don's calling from Manchester. Hi, Don. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. I'm Mo Udall, Don Udall. Mo Udall's youngest first cousin. He ran for president back here. And we travel extensively. My wife is from Taiwan. And your points are extremely well taken. And it's I think it's one aspect of our tapestry. But I would differ somewhat in that here I'm from the Southwest, Arizona, then California, but went to school in Utah, did a mission, Mormon mission in the Deep South, and have traveled extensively in Europe. And your comments about Amsterdam are absolutely right on. We just got back from Turkey and Jerusalem, and a long trip to China before that. And so I somewhat disagree that we're more cohesive than perhaps you're giving credit. I think that our Americanism is from the fact that we fought so many wars, quotes, together, some of them very, you know, controversial, alas, many. But the First and Second World War were so cohesive. And I see us as primarily Americans, much different from the culture you describe outside of Amsterdam, which is, you know, it's very interesting and laudable even. But we are Americans.
Don, we've been described as an optimistic people overall.
We are, and Ron, I'm back here trying to help one of the candidates, and I think they're all good. And you know, we've had many different quote civil wars. When Tilden surrounded Washington D.C. with Rutherford's electoral college victory, Tilden had won the primary. I mean the majority vote.
All right. Well, Don, I'm going to let you go, and I really appreciate your call, because I kind of had this sense, too, after reading the book, Colin. I thought, wow, is there nothing that unites us? Nothing?
Well, obviously, there are things that unite us because we have succeeded in keeping this unwieldy coalition together, and thankfully so for world history. I mean, it's been enormously important, nor am I encouraging or an advocate that the country should break apart. But look at just today, look at the polarization that we're facing and lamenting, rightly so, where the institutions of the federal government, which are built, by the way, on compromises between these regional cultures' view of how society should be built. There are inherent contradictions in our Constitution and all sorts of checks and balances, in part because of that the regions distrusted each other so much. But the lesson of that is that the institutions of the federal government are intentionally designed that they cannot function without compromise between parties. And when you reach a state where nobody can compromise, the federal institutions cease to function. And they are the thing that really holds us all together. So I mean, the fact that we that unity is a problem that rises up in our history, I think, is undeniable, and that we're at one of those junctures where those problems are at a fore again. There are times when these issues go quiet. I mean, World War II brought us all together, and almost all of the regions gathered around, say, a figure like Dwight Eisenhower. I mean, there are times when these things are put aside, but they rise up again. I mean, look at the 1960s, both the civil rights movement and the Cultural Revolution, which have enormous fissures and differences in reaction on a regional level, and certainly today. These are things that flare up and come and go, but have serious implications for the conduct of politics in our country and for understanding and negotiating our future.
Well, and I hear you on some of the political questions, you know, that you described earlier, regional differences over the role of government, the role of religion, what does freedom mean? But Don is hitting on something. Is there an American character? Again, we're often described as a friendly people, an open people, an optimistic people, a sometimes naive people. Beyond these sort of fundamental political questions, is there an American character that perhaps would describe all of us?
I think there are characteristics that do describe all of us. I mean, the emphasis on freedom being important. Freedom and liberty is not something that is universally felt. I mean, look at there are other open societies, even open societies and democratic societies created by the British Empire, like New Zealand, where the emphasis is not on those terms. It's more on things like fairness. So, I mean, that importance of freedom brings us together, and we all cherish it. The problem is that the different regions to have a different definition of what freedom actually means, which is where the conversation gets difficult.
The
historical fact that regardless of what regions you were in, that you were perched on a continent sparsely populated and with enormous natural resources that allowed people to spread out, that created all sorts of possibilities that were impossible in Europe for having your own land and having your own self-sufficient farm and being able to aspire to greater things, that made us an optimistic people, as you say. So, I mean, yes, there are things about our history that we share, but you can say the same thing about Europeans. There are all kinds of things that make Europeans Europeans as a group, and yet within the rubric of Europe, there are very different nations with very different histories and attitudes that don't always get along. And I'm saying that we're analogous in many ways to that experience. Yes, you could compare and contrast European and American culture and be absolutely right, but you would only be seeing things at one order of analysis, and you would be hard put to figure out why it was then that we ended up fighting a civil war and why the institutions of government for the past decade or two have been caught in a vicious stalemate with common ground extremely elusive.
Well, let's take another call, Colin, if we could. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. Don, thanks for that one. Up next is Bert in Portsmouth. Hi, Bert. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thanks.
Good morning.
I must tell you, my interest in regionalism began in 2004 when my then 8-year-old daughter asked on a certain November day, did Kerry win? And we told her, no, he didn't. She asked, did he win New England? We said, well, yes, he did. And her next obvious question was, can he be president of New England? From the mouths of babes. My question is, isn't Pat Buchanan right in a lot of ways, and he's taken tremendous flack for this, for being divisive, when he said in 1992, famously, that there's a culture war, a war for the soul of America? Isn't that still accurate, and is it not absolutely irresolvable, and do we not see that now in the presidential election of 2012?
Oh, Bert, thank you so much for calling in. Go ahead, Colin. Good question.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure if there's a culture war quite the way Mr. Buchanan would define it, but absolutely there is one, and there's been one going on for a very long time. I mean, the current chapter is rightly identified as being a product of the aftermath of the tumultuous situations in the 1960s, both the civil rights movement, where essentially the Deep South and Tidewater and parts of Appalachia had a resolution of a destruction of a effective race-based caste system imposed on them by the other nations and the federal government. And that was an extremely divisive situation. And then in the culture wars, if you look at it in regional terms, a lot of it boiled down to strong differences on whether or not the changes of the 1960s were a good or a terrible thing. And it boiled down often on regional grounds as to where support or opposition to these changes were taking place.
So these differences irresolvable, that Bird asks?
They are extremely difficult to resolve if you go to the poles. I mean, as you said, there are 11 regional cultures identified on the continent. There are ways to find consensus between numbers of them, in fact, perhaps ones representing a majority or a supermajority of the people living on the continent. But I don't think you're ever going to find resolution between the polar extremes on some of these issues, say the feelings about the balance between individual freedom and common good between, say, Yankeedom and the Deep South. I mean, you have what's the correct balance between deregulating an individual freedom as it would play out in the marketplace, and and corporations and banks and the like, and regulating those to ensure that they don't somehow damage or form tyrannies, it's going to be very hard to reconcile those two positions.
So,
You see those played out in the sort of Deep South and Yankee. So what I'm saying is, no, I don't think you're ever going to get all of the regions to reconcile their differences. What you
too
might
difficult.
Be able to do,
too deep.
They are too deep and too far apart and too strongly held. What you may be able to do, though, is to have a number of the regions compromise and come together in a sort of supermajority consensus, that the continent will have consensus even if certain regions are left out of that and extremely upset by it. So that, no, you can't reconcile some of the biggest differences, but yes, you could find consensus on the broad stage between coalitions of some of these cultures.
Well, doing the research that you have, Colin, I mean, did you ever think, why bother? You know, why don't we just break into a couple countries? Maybe that would be easier and more convenient and everybody would be happy.
I think if you could snap your fingers and divide into five or so, you know, new countries, probably that would be true. I think that there'd be a lot less stress and people would be able to build the societies they want without those awful people from the other region confounding them and getting in their way. And you know, they could be happy trading partners and so on and so forth. However, my experience, you know, I was a foreign correspondent and a journalist. I was an East European Studies major in university and then was a foreign correspondent from 89 and through the early 1990s in Eastern Europe and the Balkans. And that's a place with strong fissures that don't match state and international boundaries and deep historical grievances and differences. And everybody was aware of their history there, and it evolved with extreme tragedy. And the lesson that I took from being in Bosnia in the aftermath of the war and covering the ethnic tensions and such there is that the veneer of civilization is much thinner than we sometimes think it is. So I'm not one who would advocate attempting to go down that road because I don't have enough assurance sort of in the human condition writ large that it would occur peacefully.
That's interesting. So given your experience there in the Balkans where
too risky.
You know, everybody said breaking up is the only thing we can do, you saw it and you said, boy, the result was pretty bloody.
Well, yeah. And you have a place like Sarajevo, which was a cosmopolitan, sophisticated city where people embraced, the differences between the ethnic groups they thought didn't matter. And, you know, when things fall apart, it can get really, really ugly. So, yes, I'm risk averse in that respect. So I hope that our continent and country, in fact, does find a way to reconcile things because, well, the end result of being able to split up might be might make for a better comedy between
Colin,
the
I got to cut you off there. I
sorry,
apologize. And we will take a short break. More of your calls coming right up.
The legacy one leaves for a community can last for generations. I'm Anna Moskoff, Plan Gifts Officer at NHPR, and I'd like to talk to you about the many ways in which you can support NHPR, like leaving a gift through your estate. You can make a lasting impact on this new service for the next generation of public radio listeners in New Hampshire. For more information, please call 800-639-4131 or visit the support page at nhpr.org.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock, providing online health tools and podcasts for a healthier New Hampshire. Information at dartmouthhitchcock.org. And from Absolute Resource Associates, providing environmental services to address concerns such as mold, asbestos, lead, and indoor and air water quality. AbsoluteResourceAssociates.com. Coming up at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, a look at concerns over online privacy. New Hampshire weather for today, mostly sunny with high temperatures from 25 in the North Country, 35 to 40 in central parts of the state, and 45 in southern New Hampshire. Tonight, clear and cold, low temperatures near zero north, teens across central New Hampshire, and 20 in southern sections of the state. Tomorrow, starting out sunny in the morning, then clouding up in the afternoon with high temperatures from 35 north, ranging to 45 in southern New Hampshire. This program was recorded earlier. We won't be taking any new phone calls this morning. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, our guest is Colin Woodard. He's a writer, historian, journalist, and author of the book we're talking about, American Nations, A History of the 11 Rival Regional Cultures of North America. By the way, there's a fascinating map in Collins' book, and if you want to see it, it's on our Facebook page. We'll try to get it on our website later today, but if you're on Facebook, go to our brand new Facebook page and check out this map. It's real interesting, showing the 11 rival regions Colin describes. Our number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Colin, here's an email from Keane that I want to share with you. This is from Deepa in Keane. He says, as someone from India, where regional differences are so obvious, vivid, and pronounced, language, dress, food, religion, the U.S. seems pretty uniform to me, relatively speaking. Also talking to older Americans, I also gather that regional differences are getting less pronounced. Maybe consumer capitalism, marketing the same goods, the same lifestyles, and mass media are flattening out cultural differences within the country, and eventually maybe across the world, too. This is a great point, Deepa. Thank you so much. Colin, what do you think?
Yeah, there is the mass culture and these homogenization of the, you know, the landscape and where we shop and watching similar programs and stuff. And you would think that that would even out and erode the differences between these regional cultures. But again, the observable evidence is quite the opposite, that the differences remain and remain profound, and we see it every day in the news from Washington and as well in many other ways.
Deepa, thanks for the email. And our number, 1-800-892-6477. Dallas is up from Concord. Hi, Dallas. Go ahead. You're on the exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, Laura. I actually agree with your guest, and I am one of the Yankees. And the reason I agree is, and then I have a question, is, you know, I travel, and sometimes I'm in other parts of this country, and quite frankly, I wonder if we're even on the same planet because of just what they discuss and, you know, what I physically see around me. I mean, a quick example is I was in Tucson or Phoenix several years ago and was up in an air balloon, and here's a place that has 365 days of sun, and all these houses, none of them have solar collectors. And so I'm like, where are you from? You know, you get free energy. But my question is, how did the author come up with the different ways of characterizing the 11 areas?
Yeah, good question, Dallas. And if you look at the map, Yankeedom, for example, isn't just New England. It spreads over to many of the Great Lakes states. So there are some differences that don't seem obvious at first blush. What do you think, Colin?
Yes, well, the fundamental differences and characteristics were laid down with the initial settlement of the colonial clusters. So many of the salient characteristics you see today in playing through our history, say, from New England and the greater New England cultural space, date back to the assumptions and institutions that the Great Puritan Experiment laid down on the landscape, which I outlined, you know, briefly about the community freedom being organized around the community as an entity. You know, the first thing you do when you reach the frontier was to lay out house lots as a community organism and tax yourselves to immediately build a school and a meeting house. And it's a, you know, congregational meeting houses because the congregation had control over affairs. There were no bishops or anyone above you, and you all meet in direct democracy in a meeting house to decide how the community will be governed. That's a very different pattern and take than other parts of the country. So it's these characteristics and assumptions which the true founding fathers laid down in each of these regional cultures or nations. And those founding fathers, by the way, are not the people who came together in 1775 and 1789. It's their great-grandfathers and great-great-great-grandfathers and such who laid down the original colonies. As to where they spread, I mean, the amazing thing is that these cultures thereafter developed an remarkable isolation from one another and spread across the continent up to the Mississippi River up through the 1820s in almost mutually exclusive settlement bands, both because they were pursuing, you know, areas where the agricultural practices they were accustomed to could continue, but also, importantly, they were avoiding one another. You know, the advice and publications for, you know, people, emigrants considering moving to the West, wherever the West was at the time, often emphasize, you know, go to this place and don't go to that one because, you know, those people we can't stand from those other parts of the country are taking over that area and will corrupt your children. You have to go to these areas. And, you know, they were intentionally sorting. And indeed, later immigrants, we were talking about the 19th century ones, often were making choices based on some of these characteristics as well. And so the map you see is, in essence, the where what colonial cluster colonized which segments of the country. And in the case of Yankeedom, I mean, from New England, much of upstate New York was colonized from New England because Massachusetts actually claimed great swaths of upstate New York as being part of Massachusetts. And the compromise that was negotiated was that, no, New York will have sovereignty, but Massachusetts, the state of Massachusetts, will actually own the property rights. And so Massachusetts organized the colonization of those areas through big land companies bringing, you know, often entire towns of people would transplant from one part of Massachusetts to this part of New York, bringing their Calvinist minister with them and immediately laying down New England institutions. Ditto for the Western Reserve of Ohio. It was the Western Reserve of Connecticut. Same pattern of people coming from Connecticut. And then Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, those Great Lakes states, were colonized largely by New Englanders or people from the aforementioned parts of Ohio and New York who dominated the territorial legislatures and the constitutional conventions that and the early governorships of those places. So that is an example of how the map is drawn, and it's tracing the spread of the, you know, cultural DNA, as it were, of these Euro-American settlement patterns as they push their way across the continent and pushed aside or destroyed or co-opted the Aboriginal societies that had been there before.
Dallas, thanks a lot for the call. And let's take Dave in Manchester. Hi, Dave. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, good morning. I've missed the beginning, so I just apologize. I don't know the author's name. But I wanted to take issue with the characterization, I mean, including Canada in the region, I mean, Canadian regions in the regions, because it totally ignores as Canadians would characterize the first American Civil War in 1776. So now they're two different countries. And I think, you know, it doesn't recognize that distinction. I know there was discussion earlier about how, you know, European regions or countries, Western European countries, they have liberty, but they're different than us. Well, I think that would be a good point to talk about how Canada has the same history to that point during the Revolution or the first Civil War. And just doesn't, from what I heard, which I might have missed the beginning, it kind of characterizes in the eastern Canadian provinces, Atlantic provinces, as part of the American culture. And it's not. I mean, at least the political culture is completely or very different. So I think there should be a distinction there.
Yeah, Dave, I'm glad you called. I had a similar question. You know, why include Canada and Mexico in this? And does that, well, do them a disservice in saying, yeah, you're just really part of us?
I'm glad you raised that because, first of all, the book very much includes Canada and northern Mexico in its analysis and argues that the international boundaries are not important. But the caller may agree or disagree with this, but these colonial clusters, some of them extended over what is now the U.S.-Canadian border and extended and colonized and passed some of these institutions and assumptions over broad swaths of Canada. I mean, you have the New France, who is a very different society, which dominates much of what is now Quebec and parts of Acadia, but the rest of the Maritimes, by and large, were effectively colonized by New Englanders, even to the effect that the Loyalist experiment in New Brunswick was unable to dislodge them. And the areas of Ontario were largely settled, you know, when Upper Canada was broken off from the rest of Quebec and created Ontario, the initial settlers, these sort of late Loyalists and people, were people coming from specific parts of the mid-Atlantic portions of what's now the United States, who are bringing very specific regional cultural characteristics that you see through to today, and so on and so forth. The big difference culturally with the political culture of Canada and the political culture of the United States is that the mix of nations that comprise English-speaking Canada is a completely different mix than the United States. I mean, if you'd like to know, you know, what would the United States be like if the South had seceded, if you didn't have Tidewater and Appalachian, the Deep South, it might resemble more Canada. The other factor, and in addition to the existence of New France pulling politics in a sort of what we would call today a leftward direction, is that in the aftermath of the American Revolution, the British Empire took many measures to ensure that the Canadian colonies wouldn't rise up again, including not having them have their own institutions and having imperial officials and governors brought in from the other side of the Atlantic calling most of the shots. So some of the political institutions of government on a local level were not allowed to were taken out of the hands of the local settlers, which is why, say, in the maritime provinces, you don't see the same strong town government functions because the empire did not allow them to continue to form after the American Revolution because they had proven to be such a problem in keeping the colonies and under control.
Well, you say at the end of the book, Colin, you know, a reconfiguration of our current U.S. borders, so both nationally and in the states, could be different 100 years from now, could include parts of Mexico and Canada to get to our caller's point. What might some of those new boundaries look like? I mean, you know, it seems kind of, I don't know, kind of out there to suggest that the United States might not look like the United States 100 years from now, but just play out that fantasy for us.
Yeah, I mean, the book is concentrating on using the past to understand the present and who we are, but of course people invariably want to know what it's going to say about the future. I mean, the short and honest answer is we have no idea.
Right.
But if I'm going to speculate, if you look in the long term, a century down the road, I think it would be faulty to assume that the continent is going to remain three federations, that one or two or all of them might have a major reconfiguration of their borders and arrangements and constitutions. And that would apply to our country as well.
I apologize for interrupting. You're saying in 100 years from now, it's not unreasonable to think that we might not have Canada, the U.S., and Mexico as they exist today.
Right. I mean, we all know that the Mexican state is under enormous stresses right now. It's a federalized state, and the northern parts, which I put in an entity called El Norte, have a very different history and priorities and economic orientation and than the central Mexico and southern Mexico, and have tried many times in the past to secede to form a sort of third buffer society between the United States and central Mexico. So, I mean, in a scenario where for some reason Mexico, whether it be the rise of narco lords and such, sometime over the next century were to break up the same way the rest of Central America broke up and formed smaller states, you know, the Guatemalas and Panamas. The same thing could happen in Mexico. And if it did, I think it would be very likely that the northern provinces would hang together. In the case of Canada, Canada's probably the most stable arrangement now. But remember, it's only, 10, 15 years ago that the vote of Quebec separatism was defeated by some shockingly slim amount, 1 or 2%. So, I mean, that's I think that the time of Quebec separatism has probably gone by, but that's an example of the fissures that Canada also faces. You know, it's openly has been discussed the dangers of the federation breaking up. In the United States, I mean, if you look out in a century, you're just making up a sci-fi scenario as to what might form a reconfiguration of our arrangements. I mean, the whole idea of states' rights and of limiting the federal government and pushing it back and giving more sovereignty to the states, which is not just fringe opinion, especially in certain regions of the country, that is essentially reforming on sort of confederal lines, if you do that, more towards the Articles of Confederation we used to have, and be a very different constitutional arrangement than we have today. So those are just, you know, brief examples that seem entirely plausible. Now, it could be that the map will indeed remain the same, but I think it would be foolish to simply count on it.
Wow. Well, and pardon me for seeming short-sighted. It does seem, like you said, sci-fi, you know, given national pride and national feelings, again, from our neighbors in Canada and Mexico. You know, no, we don't want to be part of the sort of big, powerful brother, the United States.
I think it would be less likely that you would see parts of Canada and parts of the United States amalgamate for the reasons you say. And probably given foreseeable history that that northern Mexican provinces and the Spanish-settled borderlands of the former Mexican provinces in parts of the southwestern United States would come together, it would be a difficult political arrangement, I agree. But internally within the borders that some of these regions you might see fissures form that might actually lead to sovereignty. I mean, that's entirely possible. It's something that's been openly discussed in both Canada and Mexico entirely in living memory.
You know,
so I mean, to look forward a century, we don't know what's going to happen. Many things, you know, multiple 9/11 style attacks or some kind of massive stress on world civilization, a pandemic, you know, that creates a major crisis. We don't know. But, you know, what would happen in the aftermath of those kind of events and the stresses that it would cause, you know, it's sci-fi speculation. But a century is a long time.
Right.
And given that's what I'm saying.
Well, and, you know, you acknowledge throughout your book, Colin, that many, many other scholars, other historians, especially cultural historians, have looked at this idea of America as a collection of regions. The nine nations of North America is the one that a lot of people have heard about. So in this book, what do you hope to add to this field? What new are you presenting?
This is sort of the grand unified theory because, yes, the idea that regions are important have been out there. And the book you mentioned, Joel Grew's Nine Nations of North America, which came out in 1980, also argued that the true boundaries don't match state and international borders and had a map. The difference is that he was a journalist, as I am, so I don't knock that, but his approach was entirely ahistorical. He went around in the late 70s and said, my gosh, this part of the country seems to be experiencing the same socioeconomic problems as other parts. So he grouped them together in a snapshot in time. So that's extremely difficult when you're trying to look at the characteristics and history of a culture to be entirely ahistorical. So this is contributing actually seeing how these things unfolded and truly for the first time being able to identify the real map of the regions.
All right. Well, Colin, it's good to talk to you. Thank you very much for taking the time with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Colin Woodard. Again, his book is American Nations, A History of the 11 Rival Regional Cultures of North America. The map we talked about is on our Facebook page, so if you'd like to go there and check it out, go ahead. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Emily Johnson. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy. We'll be right back.